You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
To connect the dots, a brand new week. We have just passed the second Sunday of Lent. This makes it the second Monday of Lent. Because Lent starts in the middle of the week, which is really confusing.
Yes.
So here we are. And you are listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And this being Monday, we are here today with our good friend, Sherry Antonetti. How you doing, Sherry?
I'm doing very well, thanks. A little sleepy from missing an hour, but other than that, good.
You're recovering from the... You know, I was surprisingly not exhausted yesterday, which I often am on Sundays, just on general principle.
It's a day of rest. My body said so.
when Sunday comes, I'm like, just give me a pillow. You know, just going to lay down and I'm going to sleep this afternoon because I get to do that. And people come and they say, you know, would you like to do this or that? And I'm like, you know, I'd love to work today, but I can't. God says that.
God said I need to take a nap.
So I'm just not going to do that. You know, I'm. Of course, I have very flexible ideas of what constitutes work too. So yes. Depending, my wife is one of these people that like her form of relaxation is to get out and work her butt off in the garden, right?
Okay.
And it's like, it's not servile work. Which is what,
yeah.
If Sunday rest is really all about, this is just relaxing, fun work, as far as she's concerned. So
yeah, out to her, it's leisure. It's, you know, pleasure to do this.
Yeah. So I have that flexible attitude too. If it's fun, and I feel like doing it, then I'll work on my novel on Sunday because it's fun.
Yes.
But then again, a nap sounds really great, too.
Yes. Oh, no, my husband also likes the garden. And to me, that is not something I consider to be anything other than servile work because I am not a gardener. And so it makes him happy. I'm happy to let him do that. I'll cook all the things that he brings in from the harvest, but I do not garden.
So yesterday was taken up with so we had the granddaughters over, who are just mega cute. They started out cute and then they've just like exponentially cutified.
They have evolved cutie in their cuteness. Got it.
It's amazing. So, you know, my now almost 3-year-old granddaughter, Seraphim, she loves her papa. And she just loves to, you know, explore things with him. And, you know, she'll tell these jokes and then she'll hold her hand up to her mouth in that sort of tee way.
Yes. Oh, that's awesome.
Cute. And so he was like sitting around the living room the other day. Remembered he needed his backpack for something. He says, oh, I left my backpack down in the car. I got to go get my backpack. And Seraphim, out of the blue, looks at him and goes, oh, Papa, I am so, so sorry that he had to go down to the car and get the backpack out of the car.
Jamie, Christmas.
Where did this come from?
And I love it.
How can you be this cute? I'm going to, like, get some kind of radiation poisoning from this much cuteness. You know, it's just, she's so...
Oh, that's awesome. That's fun.
Yeah. Tyler,
3-year-olds are just fun. It's there.
And her little sister, who is just one in a couple of months, of course, she's the quiet one. So she doesn't say a lot, but everything that Seraphim is doing becomes the cool thing because Seraphim is he is the gold standard of coolness as far as Charlotte is concerned. So Charlotte wants to do whatever Seraphim's doing. So Charlotte, you know, if Seraphim's playing with a toy, then Charlotte comes over and grabs it because that's the cool thing right now.
Right.
And so she was there too. And so she's very huggy. So she climbs up on your lap and she just wants to be held. And so I was holding her and I puckered up my lips. And she's starting now to figure out how to kiss people. You know how little babies,
yes, give you the yes,
giant slobbery open mouth.
Yes, kiss. Yeah, yeah. It's like a remora kiss.
Yes. Yes. So they just kind of they put their,
yes,
their
mouth, yes,
on your face. You're just like, oh, this is so gross, but it's also adorable, you know. Yeah. So she's starting to figure that out. So she kind of now she. Her mouth is still open, but it's kind of like a pucker. It's not like wide open, you know.
You're not getting all the drool that's inside the mouth. You're just getting some of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'm sitting there and I puckered up and then she just sort of leaned forward and went and put her mouth up my lips and was like, okay, I will be grateful for this, even though this is really gross.
Oh, you're so cute. Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they're so cute. So
yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyway, that was great. And so we had the fam over yesterday, like you do on Sundays. You uh-huh. know? We hung out for a while, and then I had to go teach on the resurrection.
Oh, nice. So,
yeah, it was kind of interesting. You know, it was our CIA. You know, okay. I mean, talk about the resurrection. So I talked about, kind of making the point that, the resurrection is not something that happened in Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Right.
It's a transcendent event, but it's also a historical event. And the Gospels are taking tremendous pains to root the resurrection in time and space.
Space,
and
yes.
Cuckoo Land. So they, they spent a lot of time citing witnesses and talking about things that would have been much, you know, if they were just making up a story, it would have been a heck of a lot easier to proclaim the spiritual resurrection of Jesus. That would have been so easy for them
as opposed to the bodily one. That's
bodily resurrection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they could have just, you know,
I mean, Hercules went to Olympus in a fire. I mean, you can do that. You can pull that one off. It's already accepted in a lot of places in a lot of different myths.
Sure. And the apostles themselves were ready for something like that. So when they see the risen Christ the first time, they all thought it was a ghost. And because they were ready for that, what they weren't ready for was a glorified human body that can appear and disappear at will, but also has some kind of physicality to it.
Yeah, Jesus takes pains to eat.
Yeah, he eats fish and here, poke your finger in my side and all those kinds of things. And, that would have been so much easier for the early church. But unfortunately, they were constrained by what actually happened.
The facts, yes.
And so, you know, the Gospels are just kind of straining at the limits of land. And so is Paul. The first resurrection narrative we actually have in the New Testament doesn't come from the Gospels. It comes from 1 Corinthians 15. And exactly what, you know, Paul stuck with the same problem. You know, the Greeks that he's talking to would be just fine with some kind of ghostly apparition. That'd be great. Right. But Paul has to say, but that's not actually what happened, you know. And so he's struggling to try to put into words the experience of the risen body of Christ.
Because it's not in our experience. It's not shared experience. This is where you know, language breaks down because you're trying to explain something that's, for all intents and purposes, in every other circumstance, not happening.
Not happening, yeah. And so it's interesting, you know, the kind of language that he uses. He talks about a spiritual body, which moderns have no idea. That's like talking about an unmarried husband. You know, what does that even mean? How can there be
dry water, body? You know?
Yeah. And because when we talk about something spiritual, what we mean is disembodied. And that's not what Paul means. Paul's talking about a body that has been transfigured, which is, by the way, what we were celebrating yesterday at Mass.
Yes, yes.
Has been transfigured. It is still in some sense a spiritual body, or it is still in some sense a physical body. But what he's trying to get at is that this glorification and divinization, what the Eastern Church calls theosis, has radically transformed the body of Jesus. It hasn't annihilated it.
It's revealed it in a sense. And I always liked how C.S. Lewis talked about the new Narnia being more of the true Narnia than what we knew.
Yeah, I remember talking to a priest one time, and he was going, you know, people have difficulty with this. He says, I would have more difficulty believing this if I knew A, what matter was, and B, what the risen body of Christ was. And until somebody could tell me that the one can have nothing to do with the other, then we're really just kind of talking through our hat, you know. We don't know what we're talking about, you know.
Fair enough. So,
anything, we'll be back right after this. Listening to you, connecting to Fox, I'm Chris Mark Shea. And we are today with Sherry Antonetti. We're talking about the resurrection, and we'll be back and talk about other fun stuff, right?
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. We've been talking a bit about, I wound up teaching an RCIA class yesterday, and the mission was to talk about the resurrection. And when you talk about the resurrection, there's like just a lot of aspects to the resurrection. So when the catechism talks about the resurrection, it talks, of course, first of all, about the resurrection of Jesus. But the point of the resurrection of Jesus is that he is the first fruits, not the last fruits.
Yes.
So, you know, what the whole point of the resurrection is, as Paul keeps banging away at, if we have shared in a death like his, we will also share in a resurrection like his. So we join with that death in our baptism, but also in anticipation of the resurrection. So baptism doesn't just kill, it also brings life. So you go, you are baptized into his death, says Paul. But you also, when you come out of the water, you are baptized into his resurrection.
I'm always just in awe of how much Paul gets of all of this, so that the rest of us kind of go, I would never figure that out. Thank you, because there's no way I'd get that.
Well, it was in ancient Judaism, the waters are always symbols of death. The Jews were not a sailing people. That was the Philistines next door. They were Carthaginians, and they built their entire empire on a sort of a maritime empire. But when the Jews talk about the waters, it's always associated with death. So, you know, what happens to Jonah, right?
Right.
Okay. That's kind of, you know, so the waters have come over my head, says the psalmist. So the waters are always a symbol of death. And not surprisingly, when Jesus speaks of his death, he calls it the sign of Jonah.
You're right.
So it was unusual for Jews to make a living on the waters. This is one of the things that distinguishes the disciples of Jesus. because they were rare.
Fishermen. Yeah.
They were fishermen, and they spent, and they had a lively awareness that those waters could kill you. And tried to on a couple of occasions.
Yeah,
you know,
Lord but, save lost. Yes.
Yeah. And so resurrection, the resurrection of Jesus is a bodily resurrection. And because of that, the church is a sacramental church. So, you know, what are we doing when we are participating in the Eucharist? You were handing, well, when you're baptized, you hand your whole self over for death. So it's you're baptized in physical water. You don't have some kind of spiritual baptism or an incorporeal baptism. Spiritual baptism is baptism with water. And so that affects your body as well as your spirit. And in the same way, the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, are participations in the whole life of Christ. Why? Because it's the whole Christ who came up out of the grave. You know, he wasn't just raised as a spirit.
No, it's why he raised Lazarus. So we get that it's going to be more than just our spirit. It's going to be our whole self. No, right. You know.
Right. And that's a very Jewish take on the human person, that the human person is a union of body and soul. So, you know, the Gnostics identified purity with sterility. So the idea was to strip away the body. The body is unclean. The physical world was the creation of the evil demiurge that Jesus came to save us from.
Yeah, and they you know, they didn't, you know, body bad, spirit good. The idea that the split, that when we die, you know, the body decays, so whatever is left must be what was good.
Right. And what Catholic faith did was it didn't identify purity with sterility. Catholic faith identified purity with fruitfulness.
Yes, fecundity, yes.
Yeah. You know, and the Christian faith takes that to its zenith and says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And when the Word is raised from the dead, he's raised bodily. And he's not just raised bodily. My grandma used to say that, you know, the reason for the resurrections was so that people would know that Jesus was alive. And then when he ascended into heaven, he just kind of dropped his humanity. You know, didn't need it anymore.
No, he's still fully human even back now.
Right. And so there is a man in heaven, a fully human man, because Jesus retains his full humanity. And that has huge implications, because it means that when Jesus shares his life with us, when Jesus establishes the new covenant, it's the new covenant not in his spirit,
but in his body.
In my blood, yeah. And so that's why we receive the Eucharist, because you're receiving the whole Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. And it was interesting, because there was a guy there. You get a wide variety of people come to RCIA. They're from all over. So there's one guy there who was just kind of checking things out. He was raised in the Church of Christ, and he was interested, trying to track all this. And another lady was, you know, she was just unbaptized. And another guy looked like he was Haitian. He was a black guy. He spoke French. And I've got a friend in our parish who is Haitian, and she's got a couple of kids. So I try weekly to speak French with her, and I'm quickly ashamed. Because my high school French is pathetic, but you know, you do what you can. But anyway, there was another guy there who was he's there because his girlfriend is Catholic and she wants him to understand her faith.
Okay.
And he's really resistant. There was, like, you know, he was just kind of staring at me through the whole talk, you know, and he was just very clearly on his guard and, you know, wary of being seduced.
Afraid of being pierced. You know, it's,
yeah,
you recognize, but you know, you come and you're listening and you're afraid that what will you discover? And if you discover something, you will have to change. So if you shut your ears, I mean, there's a legitimate, like, I don't want to know that I have to do something different than what I am doing.
Yeah. Yes. So anyway, he was there. And when we started, you know, when we moved into a discussion of the significance of sacramentality and its intimate relationship to the resurrection, you know, all the force fields went up, right?
Yes.
And shields so, up. Yeah. And so it was like, well, he's speaking, you know, figuratively here, you know, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. Yeah, not so much, you know. Well, it has to be figurative. Well, why does it have to be figurative? Well, it's a symbol. Well, it is a symbol. The Eucharist is a symbol, but it's not just a symbol.
Because the apostles even asked that question.
Well, I mean, yeah, what's striking about, you know, when you read the story in John chapter 6, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. What's striking about that story is that when his disciples hear that, they do, in fact, take him to mean that we have to eat his flesh and drink his blood. And what Jesus does not do is say, hey, I'm just speaking figuratively here. Get a clue, you know? I'm not an idiot. You can't actually eat my flesh and drink my blood. He doesn't do that. He just says, so, you know? You gonna leave too?
Yeah. Right. I mean, he's just, I mean it. Do I have to start over?
Yeah. And when you get to the Last Supper, the only reference point that the apostles have for the Last Supper, they've got two reference points. One is the Passover, which is the sacrifice. And the essence of a blood sacrifice, of course, is the separation of the body and the blood. That's what you're doing in a blood sacrifice. You cut the lamb's throat and it bleeds out.
Yes.
And he's links what he's doing to the Passover sacrifice, which, by the way, was consummated by eating the lamb.
Yes. The body.
And the only other reference point they've got is that conversation from a year ago, which happened, surprise, at Passover, where he says, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink my blood, you have no life in you. And, you know, so what are the apostles supposed to make of this? Well, what's notable is that there is not a particle of suggestion that they ever took it symbolically. Probably, I think, in part because Jesus said, I'm going to die and rise from the dead. And they all said, what does he really mean by that? He must be speaking symbolically. No, that wasn't symbolic either.
Yeah, none of it was merely symbolic.
Yeah.
It was always more.
Yeah. So we will be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Sherry Antonetti. We're talking about the resurrection and other stuff. And we'll be right back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
Me, just, you know, kind of talking too much.
No. I was enjoying listening. I truly was learning a lot and enjoying hearing all about the resurrection. And I was like, well, I'm getting a little catechism today. It was great. You know?
Well, part of what's interesting about the resurrection narratives, I have a sort of a private theory.
Okay.
About the resurrection narrative, particularly in the Gospel of Luke. So what's interesting is in the New Testament, as I mentioned earlier, the first account that we have of the resurrection doesn't come in the Gospels. The Gospels are written as the apostolic generation starts to die off.
Right.
Because they're starting to realize, we're losing these guys, so we want to get this down before people come along and start, you know, coming up with fake good news.
With their own private theories and, you know.
Yeah, they've got their own things that they're doing, you know, and so that's why the Gospels were written. So what's interesting is when we first open a literary window on the New Testament church, it's not through the Gospels, it's through their internal communications with one another, specifically the letters of Paul.
Which are kind of like emails to the other people who are running churches and going, hey, pay attention, you're supposed to be doing this, and hey.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the background to all of Paul's letters. Paul's letters, with the exception of Romans, which is kind of a theological treatise, but even Romans is written, as are all Paul's letters, are written under the lash of urgent pastoral necessity. So that's why Paul is writing every one of his letters, is because he's got some pastoral fire in a church that's already been founded either by him or somebody else. And he's trying to deal with it. So when he's writing to the church at Rome, he's dealing with the problem of an ethnically mixed community.
Right.
That's, you know, half Gentiles and half Jews. And the Jews in the community have this notion. Essentially, what the Jewish Christians in the community have gotten into their heads is they've forgotten that they are all on a cancer ward, which is what the church is. And the Jewish Catholics in the community have gotten it into their heads that the game that we're all playing is who is the least terminal.
That's a good way. I like that. That's kind of like we're going on now. Things haven't changed since Paul's time.
Right.
I don't know if you saw, but there was a brouhaha over the fact that priests give blessings to children who don't receive communion, and that's not liturgically correct.
Merciful heaven.
Yeah, I was like, really? I'll take every blessing you want to throw on my kids. Yeah, and you too.
Here, you know, but people get worked up, and of course we do this today, right? So you know, today the people who boast about being the least terminal tend to be the, you know, like the Latin mass super zealots, right? Yeah. People who go to a lowly, despicable, disgusting Novus Ordo mass.
With guitar, and drums.
Yeah. So, you know, we're the least terminal because our mass is in Latin. And we play those games all the time. Anybody can do this, you know. We're always looking
God
for some
will
way
like to, me better. Yeah. I'm more pure.
Yeah. And so Paul's got that problem in the church at Rome, and he also has that problem in Galatian churches. So because the gospel comes out of a Jewish milieu, and so it was very natural for Jewish Christians to look down on Gentile Christians and say, you guys are, you know, Johnny come latelys. I mean, we've been, you know, listening to God for centuries, and now the fulfillment of all the prophets have came to us, right? In fact, you can even find sayings of Jesus. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So you can tell who he really likes the best, right?
Mom likes me best.
and so that whole dynamic is going on in the church. And so Paul has to write repeatedly to Christians to say, you know, look, in Christ Jesus, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. Nobody's better than anyone else. Why? Because all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We're all here in a cancer ward, and it's really stupid to boast about who's the least terminal.
Because we're all terminal, just so you know, FYI.
So, and Paul's got all kinds. That isn't the only pastoral issue that he's got to deal with. So when he's writing to the Corinthians, you know, he's writing to a church that's, you know, they're treating poor people like dirt. They're getting drunk at the at mass.
Yeah, they're bringing their own food and then not leaving any for anyone else. I mean, it's really.
Yeah, and they're just doing all, you know, and some people are like, hey, I speak in tongues. That makes me super awesome, you know, and you're a loser because you don't have my spiritual gifts and et cetera. And so he's got to write to the Corinthians twice. Say, get it together, you guys, you know. And yes. And they're fighting about, like, you know, I heard the gospel from Peter. Well, I heard it from Paul. Well, I heard it from Apollos, you know, and there's that. And there's and among other things, there are also Greek Christians in particular have a real problem with the resurrection. So they're trying to come up with ways of fudging it. Well, there isn't. It's not really a resurrection. You see, it's actually a spiritual thing, and et cetera. And that's why Paul has to write his account of the resurrection. And what's interesting is that when he does it, he doesn't use his own words. So he says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received." That's important language. That's code language. It's rabbinic jargon because Paul's a rabbi. And what it means is I'm handing on a tradition that I didn't invent. So what he's going to say next is not his own words. It's a creed. So he says that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas. That's another name for Peter.
Yes.
12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James. This is significant. We'll return to this. Then to all the apostles. And then after he's recited that little creed, then he tags on his own bio sketch. Last of all, if someone untimely born, he also appeared to me. That's his own language. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that he uses this creedal language. And he's giving you, if you will, a kind of an ecclesial summary of resurrection appearances that's weighted toward the testimony of apostolic figures. Why does that matter? Well, it matters for a couple of reasons. The first reason it matters is because there's one name in this list that you don't hear. And it's Jesus. The only time. No. The only time you don't hear her name, you always hear it in every other resurrection narrative. You don't hear Mary Magdalene's name.
You're right. Okay.
And that's interesting because what he's doing here is he's listing off apostolic appearances. So Cephas, the 12, he tosses in 500 brethren at one time. That's probably a reference to the appearance that's also referenced in Matthew's gospel, where Jesus goes to Galilee and appears to a whole bunch of the brethren. But he also mentions that he appeared to James.
Yes.
And I think that that's really interesting because when you hear the story of the resurrection in Luke's gospel, Luke, remember, is a disciple of Paul's.
Yes.
And so, in part, what you're hearing is the gospel as Luke has it from Paul. But not just Paul. Luke has obviously done a lot of homework, and he's probably, among other people, talked to the Blessed Virgin, and he's talked to the church at Jerusalem, because he's been there. When he tells the story of the disciples on the Emmaus Road, it's interesting that what you get on the Emmaus Road is the testimony of Clopas. That's why you know one guy's name in that story. When an ancient historian, and that's what Luke is trying to write as, when an ancient historian wants to cite his source, what he does is he mentions the name of his source in the story that the source is relating. So that's why, right, you know Bartimaeus's name, who's a completely unimportant person. Why do you know that story? Because Bartimaeus told that story 50,000 times.
There you go.
After this, listening to Connecting the Dots, I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with, Sherry Antonetti, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. And we're been talking about the resurrection. I was going to say, the Gospels, part of the way that they footnote their sources is by naming them. Where possible, you know, or where it's advantageous. And by the way, it's also significant where they don't name people. So the woman who anointed Jesus's feet and washed them with her hair, she doesn't get a mention. She doesn't get named in earlier Gospels. But when Jesus talks about her, he talks about her not as though, you know, these women are a dime a dozen. Everywhere I go, they're always, you know, drying on my feet and drying them with, you know, and anointing my feet. And this happens to me all the time, right?
Right.
He says, this woman is going to be remembered for this wherever the gospel is preached. So this is a singular act.
Yes.
This is not something that happened all the time. And yet we don't know her name in earlier tellings of the story. But when you get to John's gospel, John introduces Mary of Bethany as the woman who did this before he doesn't get around to telling that story until the next chapter. And so when he mentions Mary of Bethany's name, he says, well, of course, as essentially he's saying, as everybody knows, Mary of Bethany is the woman that did this. And that is interesting. Because the question then is, why didn't the early Gospels mention her name? And why is John feel so free to do that?
Well, I would say because they all know who they're talking about. And so would know that too.
And also because she's dead now.
Yeah.
Because remember, her brother is a wanted man was a wanted man, as John tells it. It's her brother, Lazarus, who's raised from the dead. And what's the response of the Sanhedrin to that? It's not, wow, Jesus must be the Messiah. We should all follow him. It's, yeah, let's kill him, right? And so that family has a reason to keep their head low.
Yeah.
And so the earlier Gospels don't mention them by name. But by the time John's writing his Gospel, they're safely dead. And everybody within the Christian community knows who they are. And so John does that. And so the use of names is really significant in the gospel. And that's not surprising because the use of names is hugely significant in the Jewish tradition. Names tell who you are. It matters what, they don't call Jesus just Tom, Dick, or Harry. Why do they call him Jesus? Because his name means the Lord is salvation. So it defines who he is. And so when Luke tells the story of the encounter on the Emmaus Road, what's interesting is that he gives us the name of one guy, but not the other guy.
Well, we just learned who the other guy was from
Paul. It's Clopas.
Yes.
Luke tells us that. His name is Clopas. And Clopas isn't just anybody. Clopas, it turns out, is first of all, not surprisingly, you may be shocked to learn that he was the husband of a woman known as Mary, the wife of Clopas.
Creative. I am stunned. I would never have guessed that in a million years.
But what the Gospels also tell us is that Clopas and Mary are the parents of James.
Oh, wow.
Of Jerusalem. And interestingly, although Luke doesn't tell us the name of the other guy on the road with Clopas, Paul tells us that Jesus appeared to James.
Right.
And now this is just an opinion, and it will never be anything more than an opinion of mine, but it's my opinion that James is the other guy.
Right.
It would be perfectly sensible.
And it'll be fun to find out, which we will eventually.
We will eventually,
But I'm really enjoying hearing all this because I admit, as a cradle Catholic, my biblical literacy is probably on par with the average cradle Catholic, meaning it's not so awesome.
What all this does for me is that there's a terrific essay by Dorothy Sayers called "A Vote of Thanks to Cyrus." And she talks about her first experience reading a New Testament with a commentary in it, in which it mentions, or actually not a New Testament, an Old Testament. And she's reading about one of the prophets talking about Cyrus. And it was a shock for her because she suddenly connected the Cyrus in the Bible with the Cyrus in Greek literature. And she was like, well, but I knew all about Cyrus. He was like a real person. He was like, because in Greek literature, these are actual people that we're talking about. They're not Bible characters. And it began to dawn on her at that point that Bible characters were actually real people who actually lived, and occupied the same world as Socrates and Julius Caesar and all the rest of it. And that's what this does when you start looking at the New Testament narratives, you start realizing that what you're reading is not people writing once upon a time just so stories about something that happened long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away.
And they're not a bunch of people who got together and said, let's invent a philosophy that everyone will embrace so that we can really control the world.
You're talking about people that their audience knows personally. For example, when you read Mark does something that no other gospel writer does. He mentions, just as an aside and for no reason that contributes to the narrative at all, when he gets to the part about Simon of Cyrene carrying Jesus's cross with him,
right,
he just throws in that Simon of Cyrene is the father of Alexander and Rufus. He's the only gospel writer that does that. And the question is, why does he do that? And the answer is, Rufus is a member of the church at Rome that he's writing to. So he's basically saying, that guy that sits in the third pew from the front?
His father.
He's the guy that helped Jesus carry the cross. And they're all like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. And that you realize that the gospel narratives are talking about something that is for their audience very historically immediate. Most of the events that we're talking about are things that happened, you know, if they were being written today. For Mark, Mark is talking about events that happened during the Reagan administration.
Right.
It's not that long ago, you know, or the Bush one administration, you know, and most of the people that they happen to are still walking around. They're still alive. Some of them are like right there in your church. And that you realize that we're not talking when we're reading these resurrection narratives, we're not reading something that's being told to us as, you know, once upon a time in a land far away. What people are being told are these are things that occurred that involved people that you know.
And they're real people. They make mistakes. They make false assumptions. They get corrected. They screw up. They're afraid. They get weak. They bicker. They do all the things that tell you real people are involved in this story.
Yeah, and they say dumb things. You know.
Yes.
And especially in Mark's gospel, when it comes to Jesus, you know, Jesus says. Especially in Mark's gospel, just really you hear odd things in Mark's gospel, really peculiar exchanges. I think my favorite one is the guy where, you know, he's blind and Jesus comes and, you know, I think rubs spit in his eyes or something.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he says, what do you see? And he says, I see people. They look like trees walking around, which is like, that's an odd thing to say.
And then he try it now, you know.
And Mark, you know, that's the kind of thing that you don't invent, especially if you're inventing a God figure.
He would be able to just make it work the first time, no problem. You know, your eyes are good to go now.
Where God says, how's this? Oh, it's not quite. Okay, let me try this. You know, that's a really strange story, you know, but it's there because Mark is constrained to report. Yeah. And Mark does something else, too. He mentions, and he's the only gospel writer that mentions this, that there was a young guy in the Garden of Gethsemane who, when they grabbed him, he basically just kind of wriggled out of his clothes and ran off buck naked.
Yes.
Into the night. Why is that story there? That story is there as the church's tradition has reported from time immemorial, because that's Mark talking about himself. He was there that night. Wow. He saw what happened with his own eyes. And did not cover himself with glory.
Yeah, no.
So anyway, I want to thank you so much, Sherry Antonetti, for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And our producer today was Mr. Danny Head. And we'll be back tomorrow with Michael Litchens and our special guest, Cynthia Smith. So we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.